Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This. Let's begin the show tonight with an update on the COVID-19 cases in Malaysia. The Health Ministry has confirmed today that the Selangor resident, who was the first Malaysian to test positive for COVID-19, has now made a full recovery and has been discharged. This means that so far, 9 people in Malaysia have recovered from the COVID-19 virus. No new cases of COVID-19 were reported today. That means the number remains at 22 confirmed cases. Globally, at last look, there were 71,422 infections and 1,777 deaths across 30 countries. Now, COVID-19 has triggered a variety of responses from governments, scientists and the public. But our guest tonight argues that fighting COVID, a threat like COVID-19, requires an all-of-science global response. Now, to quote his article, as outbreaks are also a psychological, political and social phenomenon, we may need sociologists, psychologists, philosophers, ethicists, media practitioners, crisis management experts, policymakers and senior civil servants in the decision-making room. Joining us on the show, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Koswe King, physician and global health expert at Oxford University. Welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Now, my first question is, I'd like to begin, I guess, by looking at the what we know about the case. So the first case of this coronavirus was reported on the 31st of December. So it's been about a month and a half now. What do we know so far about COVID-19 and what lessons have we learned about this disease?
We continue to get more information that confirms a lot more of the knowledge that we know and we don't yet know. Mm-hmm. For example, we know that the R0, which is a symbol for how infective the disease is approximately 1 to 4 right now. But contrast this with measles, where one patient can infect 40 other people, giving you an R0 of 40. So in a way, the coronavirus or COVID-19 may not be as infectious as certain diseases. Mm. What we also know is a case fatality rate is hovering between 2 to 4%. And you may ask, why is it 2 or why is it 4? And the number depends on how many people that you actually calculate in the denominator of it. When you have 71,000 people who are affected, if the number continues to grow, the 71,000, then the number could drop, the case fatality rate could drop from 4% to 2% as well. So roughly, these are the two facts that we know of, but the numbers will continue to change. Mm. And it may be possible that we will only confirm the number many months after the outbreak has finished.
So there's a bit of a lag, a time lag in terms of data.
Yeah, I want to ask you though, I mean, the comparison's always interesting, right? Because you mentioned measles, which we've now come to accept as a childhood disease and so on and so forth, and there's no terror around the mention of measles, but COVID-19 and people run for the front door, don't they? So how should we actually deal with this fact that the comparisons with other diseases might actually give a sense of proportion to COVID-19 that we don't seem to have, at least in our media and our reporting of it?
Mm. Racially speaking, if you compare the two numbers, for example, MERS-CoV has a 40% fatality rate and SARS has about a 30% fatality rate. With a 2% fatality rate or even a 4% fatality rate, rationally, you shouldn't be scared. Mm. However, in the population right now, there's a lot of panic, Sharad, and the panic's manifesting in some unusual ways. For example, in Singapore, there's a lot of panic buying, supplies are going off the shelves, and the Prime Minister of Singapore had to come on national TV to reassure the Singaporeans that everything's going to be okay.
And leave some food for the people from Johor Bahru. So they can eat something.
I think there was also panic buying of toilet paper.
True. That kind of fear, I guess, is quite understandable as well. There are many reasons for this fear, all of them very understandable. Firstly, we fear the unknown. Secondly, we fear that the information that we have is sometimes changing, and we feel fearful because we don't know why the information continues to change. We look at different governmental responses, for example, and we think, it's quite interesting because why is my country behaving this way and other countries are perhaps behaving in a different way and they are becoming safer, for example, in our perception. So all these discrepancies and a fear of the unknown could give us a lot of fear. But this fear, Sharad, if I can continue a little bit, is to say that this fear is actually very powerful. And because it's so powerful, we can harness it. more than ever right now, we're very conscious about washing our hands. More than ever right now, we're conscious about vaccinating our children, taking care of our general health, and making sure that we seek medical attention when we need to. These are good ways that we can harness the fear in a way.
Well, okay, so that's how fear on an individual level, right, and how we can harness that perhaps. But you also mentioned, government response, and fear has been one of the things that perhaps has influenced government behaviour. What have you learnt from the past 1.5 months in terms of how governments think when responding to an outbreak like the COVID-19?
This outbreak is very different from the 2009 H1N1 outbreak and maybe even 2003 SARS outbreak as well, and indeed all the previous outbreaks that we had. There are several reasons for these changes. Firstly, there's declining trust in governments all around the world, not just in Asia Pacific. Secondly, the rise of social media, where we have to contend with this volume of information coming at high speeds at us from a variety of sources, and we can't verify all this information. These are two very tectonic changes leading to governments perhaps inappropriately, in some cases, politicizing some of their responses. We should rely equally on science, because like I mentioned in my article, there is a place for an all of science response. There's also a place for politicians to provide leadership, political, moral, and even statesman-like leadership to ensure that populations don't panic. However, if you're pandering to the masses and reacting to mob mentalities and you're just succumbing to what the hysteria of the mob wants, then it's actually not a very constructive response.
I mean, the flip side of that would say that people want their governments to perform and they want governments especially to take decisive action. Shutting down a city, closing off borders seems to be the decisive action. But you make the argument that that actually, and the evidence shows, that that's not exactly effective.
This is true, Sharad. Let me go to the first point of what you made. Could travel bans be effective? Theoretically, yes, if you can completely isolate everyone from your country. But if they're already self-sustaining, human-to-human transmissions within your country, and then you raise the barriers and prevent anyone else from coming in, it's a bit of a case of where you're closing the door after the horse has bolted. I think, secondly, travel bans could lead to a situation where people are in a state of complacency and they feel safe, because a magic solution has dropped from the sky. We've prevented the foreigner from coming in, and therefore we don't have to care for our health anymore. And then thirdly, there could be a situation where we don't rely on the health system's responses because we think that the magic solution has already been achieved. So these are reasons why travel bans are generally not effective and have not really been proven to work. There could be one potential benefit, though. The potential benefit is that it buys some political space for the countries to operate in. For example, they're seen as taking decisive action, therefore they have some legitimacy. They buy some time. This is true. The lockdown in Wuhan of 50 million people did buy 2 to 3 days for the
Just
Chinese.
Just 2 to 3 days.
That's what the data shows at the moment. It could be shorter or further than that, but it seems not conceivable that it prevented anything, because there are now 3 or even 5 provinces in China with perhaps self-sustaining human-to-human transmissions as well. So it's delayed rather than eliminated the risk.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back and continue this conversation, especially looking at what an all-of-science approach means. Stay tuned to consider this.